I am the great eraser from the drawing show. Thank you, thank you. I can't hear the standing ovation I'm certain you're all giving, but I assure you, it's well deserved for a prestidigitator of my tenure. Behold, as they make these next few hours disappear.
Kia ora and welcome to MuckPod, the Muck Putty community podcast, where we chat with the talented folks who help us make cool stuff about what they do, how they do it, and what's inspiring them. I'm one of your hosts, Josh Marchand, and who is here with me today, as always?
I'm your other host. I'm Simon Crane. I'm an animator here at Muck Putty. And joining us, Josh, today, big guest, Stacey Eberschlag, all the way from Canada. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be asked to be here.
It's so good to have you here. We feel very fortunate that you decided to do this.
And am I right, this is your first podcast? You haven't done one of these before ever?
No, and I, you know, I've often been told by people, oh, hey, you know, have you checked out this person's podcast? And I always think, you know, one day I'm going to figure out what these podcasts are. But I don't know if it's a podcast or something you watch or you listen to. I actually tried to watch yours, and I didn't even really know how to get on it. I'm a real one-trick pony. I do harmony, and I don't know how to do anything else.
Hey, harmony is complicated enough. Yeah. That's one skill. That's all you need.
Maybe. It keeps you working anyway.
And it's fairly harmony is a, you know, it's a relatively involved program. I sometimes find, even using Flash, there are times when I need to tune out and stop listening to whatever video or podcast I'm listening to because I need to focus all my attention on the program, making it do what it needs to do. That's really what podcasts are for, is filling silences. You know, when I'm on the bus or I'm walking down the street, that's when I'm listening to a podcast. Yeah. But if I need to work and pay attention, it's a distraction.
Yeah, yeah. It's an earwigging onto conversations.
It is.
I guess so. It's just like you're just paying attention to, yeah, you're just letting people into your conversations, and if they're interested, every now and again see the Joe Rogan experience. Like, you know, there'll be a little clip. Is that what it's called, the Joe Rogan experience?
Yeah, or, we've heard of it.
And there'll be a little clip on, like, I don't know, Facebook or something, and he'll be talking to somebody briefly and
his show works that way. It depends on who he has on. The little clips kind of are the best way to take them in, because he does 3-hour long podcasts. And if you don't like the guest, then they can really go on. He's doing well for himself. So,
and that is the way that a lot of podcasts get themselves sort of out there, is they'll sort of leave breadcrumbs throughout the internet of real interesting little clips, so that someone who hasn't watched the whole show will listen to a clip and go, oh, that was interesting, and want to listen to the whole thing, the whole enchilada. Yeah.
With podcasts, like, I used to listen to talk radio, and especially news, and like, it used to really bum me out because it's rarely good news. And another animator, like, in a studio I worked in years ago, just turned to me and said, hey, you should stop listening to that news. It's not making you happy. Just put on podcasts. And I was like, what's a podcast? And back then it was just Ricky Gervais and Kevin Smith. They were the only two. This American Life existed at that point.
A podcast
as well
is like talk radio, except you can find whatever you're interested, you can find someone talking about that, as opposed to talk radio where it's just the general stuff, the news, what's happening in the world. So that's a bit of background on podcasts. Yep. If we're trying to sell you on the concept, I've had to do the same thing to my parents. I'm like, it's like the radio. You know the radio. But we're here talking to you today because you're a friend of the studio, and you became known to us because you had the pretty challenging task of teaching all the animators and a few of the interested directors the basics of Toon Boom Harmony. And you were doing that via, as we're doing now, a video call all the way from Canada. Not the easiest job in the world.
No, it certainly has changed. The job's changed quite a bit since I started maybe 13 years ago, where it was completely fly out to a studio, spend a week or two. Actually, we would spend any amount of time. You know, basically, there is no limit to the amount of training that you can have from us. And I guess, like, yeah, a good example of that is, like I mentioned, I spent 22 weeks last year in Italy. On an island called Sardinia, training people in person. And it's one of the few in-person trainings we did even over COVID. I think it was our seventh, eighth, and ninth training on the island. And for whatever reason, we were allowed to go there and nowhere else. And it was all right. It's a government institution, so every Monday we'd have to have our nasal swabs.
Yeah.
And one thing I realized about being in Italy is, you know, the doctors here in Canada and the dentists as well, because I had to get a little bit of dental work done there. We really baby people in Canada. We really are gentle. If you need a little bit more freezing, if you give a little bit of a whimper, the dentist stops and he gives you a bit more freezing. And over there, they're just like, they just get the job done. And it doesn't matter what kind of comfort. And the same went for the weekly nasal swab. Some of the guys actually were humane. And the rest of them were savages and really didn't care if they were hurting you or if it was uncomfortable at all. But in regards to the training, it is quite a bit different. I guess it goes back to like what we were kind of talking about earlier. The comfort level of the group at your studio, it seemed like everyone knew each other and you guys were joking around and nobody was afraid to ask questions. But in certain regions of the world, like, and I can name a few, maybe India or the Philippines, where it's a bit more of India, where it's a newer industry, and they get people in studios who are, you know, do you know anyone who's interested in art? And they'll bring them into the studio and they'll do a full training, where a lot of those people are not comfortable asking you a question, even if they don't understand. And I could start my day and say something like, we're going to start the training and today we're going to draw a circle. I'll give you a couple minutes to draw the circle. And is everyone okay? Is everyone drawing the circle? And we're going to take that circle and we're going to add some eyes to it. I'll give you a couple minutes to draw those eyes. And then eventually, you know, there'll be a certain point of the training. I keep asking, does anyone have any questions? Is anyone having any trouble? And then I will do and I think I probably did it to some of you guys at some points. I'll click on the button to share their screen. And I'll get onto the screen and they're like, oh, sir, no license. I'm sorry, sir, no license. I'm like, you didn't tell me. You didn't say anything.
they're just sitting there watching you.
The last 40 minutes, I kept asking, anyone have any problems? I'm thinking, you know what, I'm rocking this training. Everyone's just following along. Nobody's stuck. My pacing is good. Because, you know, also when you're doing it, it's very easy to get on a roll and you're explaining something. And then you realize, oh, I got to stop and let them do it now. And you know, you don't always remember your pauses. So I have had that's one of the big troubles is you really don't have an idea when people don't speak up.
And I do remember that because not only do you do training, but you do
demos.
That's it. Yeah. And so I'm guessing they just go faster because that's just like telling a room of people what the program does.
Exactly, and demo speed is so different than training speed. Sometimes when you're looking at the material and you're thinking about what to say next, because you know we have of course a little bit of a script that we can refer to, but you know when you've done it for so long, you never really look at the script, and so you're always trying to remember. Okay, so you know after we do this, you know we have to remember to mention this, because if you forget to do this, like you know it's like if I tell you to draw something and I forget to go tell you to expose it to the end of the scene, then eventually the drawing will disappear when you go to the next frame. You know, these kind of like moments in training where you're like, okay, make sure you tell them everything, otherwise you're going to have somebody stop you. It disappears. Excuse me, this is happening. You kind of start to remember the common things that people ask you after you've done a few trainings, and that's, you think, okay, make sure next time I mention this.
Yeah, yeah. So you kind of anticipate some of the things that people are going to say.
Absolutely.
And it is things like extending the exposure. It's like real simple little things, right? And it's just a case of, there's some button I'm supposed to press. Which was it again?
Or even, and then probably it happened to you at least once, people will be like, I lost everything. There's nothing there because they accidentally went to frame two. I've lost everything. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, I actually think that happened to me.
It was definitely one of the more challenging parts for from the student's point of view is going back into that classroom environment of when you have an issue, you need to put your hand up and in front of everybody say, oh, I'm having a problem. But it quickly became apparent that everyone was getting caught up on little things like that. And nobody felt any problem putting their hand up and going, I'm sorry, I still don't have this. And there would be times where I wouldn't quite have caught something, but then someone else would put their hand up. I'd watch them do it. And sometimes several people would put their hand up and go, I need you to show me how to do this. And because people kept putting their hand up, I was able to watch you walk through those steps with them and go, okay, now I've caught up. Yeah. So, and I'm sure that, like you say, you would much rather people put their hand up and say, I'm sorry, I'm having a problem, rather than the much more embarrassing situation of you call on them and it turns out they're 5-6 steps behind.
Absolutely. Because for me to stop, like, if I, you know, the example I gave you where someone hasn't spoken up and their license isn't even working. It's so hard for me when I'm in like the kind of flow of information to stop and try and find a license code or try and solve the license problem and then get them caught up to where everyone else, my perception of where everyone else is, because sometimes you'll find that there's a few people in the group that are all having trouble. So
but then your lesson has kind of lost its flow as well at that point. Then you got to kind of go back a few steps and that kind of thing.
And that's where you also get lost in your thoughts. You have a hard time remembering, well, where was I? What was I talking about last? The harder it is to remember.
To add to that, you're teaching like a bunch of different classes at the same time. Like, we weren't the only people you were teaching at that time.
Right after you, so I think I finished with you guys at 7:30. And at 8, I was doing a training until midnight with in the Philippines.
Right.
Teaching completely different classes as well. Like, it's actually somewhat better when you're not teaching the same class on like twice a day, because you do forget. Did I talk about that already? You remember. Like, where was I?
There are plenty of times when you would ask us, the class, did I cover this already? Because it's easy to lose track. The way that our training worked, being you're home in Canada and the rest of us in one big room in New Zealand, we'd all chat in the morning with our cameras on. Anyone who wanted their camera on would catch up sort of briefly, and then most people would turn their cameras off except Mike volunteered to be like our studio face, so you could see someone, and Mike would be nodding along if you asked, like, is everyone good, and if anyone had a problem, there's a button in whatever program we were using to virtually raise your hand.
That's right. Yeah.
But the raised hands didn't always work for me. It's sort of like when you wrote something in the chat, because I'm focusing on my harmony. Like, I have harmony in front of GoToMeeting.
Yeah.
So I, a lot of times I wasn't catching when, and sometimes I'll see like in the chat, there's four or five of you are like, you know, we're having this problem. I'm thinking, oh, they should have this.
You do just
put their mic on and told me they're having problems.
The students do just have to have the gall to just button with their mic and go, excuse me, sorry, something's happened.
Yeah. I would say from the perspective of a student, though, sometimes you've just lost the thread a little. You've missed out on something and you don't want to stop the class because I can figure this out. I know enough about this. I can figure it out. But then someone will put up their hand with a different problem. And that's like my time to kind of like, okay, now I can catch up. I can find out what I did wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
And then sometimes it's like you just can't figure it out and you just have to put up your hand.
Yeah, the people putting their hands up to say that they had a problem worked in a lot of different ways to our advantage. Because like you say, if you just weren't quite caught up, it was just a little bit of extra time to finish whatever you were doing. Or even just, you know, sometimes people would put their hand up and they had a problem that I had already solved. So I could go nip to the bathroom or something.
Yes.
Yeah, and that was one of the other things that in person is different. Like, when you're in a group environment, you start to see who the people that can be peer tutors would be. So there'd be times where I would, you know, I'd get up and I'd kind of be doing like a lecture, like I would do something, and then while I'm walking around, I'm just kind of talking, looking over people's shoulders, giving a lecture. And if I see someone is doing a great job and they're getting it, I can see someone who on every activity is struggling, I will peer tutor them up, because first of all, it makes the person who's showing get something out of it, because they're repeating a couple right. of times and helping people problem solving. And the other person is seeing their peers doing it easy, and they're realizing, okay, this isn't so complicated. I just have to burst through that learning bubble.
Mm.
Because that's you're kind of stuck in this bubble until you have that aha or the bubble bursts. It's like, okay, I get what a cutter does. I get why you put the cable through that port. It makes sense to me now. And then you never have to think about it again. It's complicated because it's new, but once you start to see the patterns, you're the bubbles burst and your knowledge is bigger.
I just loved that feeling. I'm the old man in the studio, so it's been a long time since I was ever in a classroom situation. And so okay. When you're younger, you kind of take education for granted. And so then to be sort of given this gift, to get this like 6-week course and to learn this, software that like I've really wanted to know about for a long time. And I've played around with it a little bit, but it just felt really good being back in a room full of people learning. Just the buzz that goes around that, by the end of the day, you know more than you did at the start of the day. And by the end of the week, you know a hell of a lot more than you did at the start of the week. And then in between, when we take breaks, we'd chat amongst each other. And so, can you do this? Can you do that? And what was that all about? And that was really invaluable to me. I sit beside, do you remember William in the class? You probably don't. You probably don't know so many students. There was on our crew, there's a guy called William, and he was getting it. Like, he really, he's got a good clean brain, you know. He takes care of himself and he's young and he's all that sort of stuff. But he was really helpful to me between the classes to just kind of, you know, just show me exactly, point to the screen where what I wasn't getting and all that sort of stuff. So, you know.
Was it you that did when I taught the particles, you put the little sparkles in the.
That was William. That was William.
Oh, that was William. Yeah. I thought, I'm going to use that the next time I do the beams of light. I'm like, that looks really good. I'm like, that's a nice. And they said, I think it was during. He did it in the beams of light.
That's right. Yeah.
The particles. I'm like, oh boy, putting two things together. I love that. So, okay, good, good.
Yeah. William is someone who has said they're not interested in coming and chatting on the podcast. That's just not something they want to do. But it's a good chance for us to just talk him up a little bit, because he is invaluable. Even with Flash, I will make the long journey. We're on the opposite side of the room, and I will walk all the way over there to ask him how to do something. Okay. He's taught me some invaluable stuff. Mm. He's really good with programs and just a good artist.
Yeah.
You've got some prime real estate there.
I know, right? Yeah. It used to be William Seaton. He left for 5 minutes and I stole it. And then when he came back, I'm like, that's my seat now.
And I sit behind Mike, who is one of our team leaders and obviously was the person on camera. So when I was going back and watching those videos, I would see myself sitting behind Mike, and there are parts where I'm slouching or I'm scratching my head or something. I'm like, Stacey could see all of that, but you were probably looking at Harmony.
Yeah, you're face bombing a bad joke I made, and
well, every day we'd sort of open up with a bit of chat. And it was very funny and also slightly like embarrassing, like how we were both sides were trading like the handful of stereotypes that we knew. We're like, what do we know about Canada? Yeah. Poutine.
Yeah.
Well, that's just it. Like the All Blacks and Kim.com. Which I now know is actually just residing there.
Yeah, well, a whole bunch of a lot more famous people have started post COVID. Heaps of people have moved to New Zealand.
Yeah, we really did quite well in COVID because we're so far away from everywhere. And we could see it sort of happening around the world. So we really locked down, you know.
Okay, yeah. Well, it's probably easier to lock down.
I think it was, yeah.
Being an actual island nation disconnected from everything. Our lockdown.
And we were just like a couple of weeks behind everybody else, which usually annoys us in New Zealand. But this time it worked out really well.
Yeah, yeah. You knew what to do because everyone else had already made the mistakes.
Kinda, well, that's it. Yeah. And you like you were saying, I was going to say it earlier on, you'd been to Italy. And I mean, isn't that, that's kind of one of the places where it struck first.
Well, it was the epicenter in Europe. Because they just, there's a lot of like physical touching. There's a lot of everything's small. Like, you know, the restaurants are small, the shopping, we have Walmart here. Like you can fire a cannon in Walmart and have no casualty. So big. Or, if the stores and everything are so small over there, there's no way to be away from them. And most people over there, even during the times where we had to, when we were flying, we're supposed to be wearing our masks on the plane, most of them had them just, as a chin hammock.
Yeah.
So nobody had it really up, and nobody seemed to care on the European carriers, whereas the Canadian carriers, they made sure it was always up and always over your face. So.
I'm gonna be real strict about that going over. You know,
wear the mask.
It's masks the whole time for me. I'm afraid, just because who wants to risk it?
Well, that's it. I went back to Ireland once the sort of world started opening up, and I had that same thing. I'm like, I'm just gonna wear the mask the whole time because. When you have a holiday, you don't want to get sick in your holiday, So I just thought.
No, absolutely not. Especially at the beginning of your holiday.
Yeah, right. Exactly. You know, yeah. Yeah.
You're flying over there, by the time you get there, 2 days in, you have your symptoms and.
It happened to be one time.
You're leaving that behind.
Yeah.
It was one of the nice things about the training is it had been a long time since all of us or a vast majority of the crew was in the studio together at one time working on a project.
Yeah.
And it would have been just so much harder, I reckon, for everybody if we were doing it where everyone was remote and everybody was at home. Being able to look over my shoulder and look at Mike or you at William
We did a little bit of Toon Boom training where it was more remote earlier on. And I looked in on a few of those lessons and they looked fine, but I kind of think that all of us being together made a huge difference.
Who did the training last time?
Benji was the guy's name.
Okay, Benji, Filipino.
Filipino,
He's one of our Filipino consultants.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, like I say, he was doing a great job. But I just think that the fact that we were all remote and we were also doing the training at the same time as working. So it was kind of like trying to kind of do it in the evenings and stuff like that. So that all those factors kind of made it a little bit harder. I was just wondering, Stacey, have you, like, how long have you been with Toon Boom? And how does that work?
How long have I been with Toon Boom? I guess I've been with them for maybe 13 years. But after 10, I stopped and I went back to work at Nelvana. Are you guys familiar with Nelvana?
Yeah,
I do know Nelvana.
Yeah, it's got the polar bear.
It's got the polar bear. Yeah. And it's probably the most incredible studio to work at anywhere, not anywhere in the world, because I just think the actual workplace is incredible. Like, have you ever seen a picture of it?
No, I don't think so.
The Chorus building is special. It's special because it's right on the water. It's got a beach next door. It has a, from Nelvana to the lobby, there's this gigantic slide that you can slide down.
No way.
They have wellness rooms there. So if you're like just a little tired or you need a few minutes, you can go online. You can book these wellness rooms that look like a beautiful 5-star hotel room anywhere in the world, and they're peaceful and they have sleep pods and massage and 5-star restaurant on the main floor. And if you have a minute, Google the photo of Chorus Toronto. That's Chorus is the parent company, and now it is in the building. But it's literally this like beautiful structure on the water.
That sounds really amazing.
Yeah, it really is. And I actually went there So in addition to working for Toon Boom right now, I've been animating on this series called, I think it's called The Hamsters of Hamsterville, but sometimes when you're working on a show, there's a name that, because I Googled it the other day, and I was like, you know, I can't find much other than like, I think it might be for Nickelodeon, because I said I found something Nickelodeon and hamsters, and they brought us all into the studio for like, you know, in which for me that was the first time I've been in that studio. So when I left Toon Boom, I went to Nelvana, but I've continued to work for them over the years. Thomas the Train and this new series, and I think a couple other shows. I'm terrible at remembering, and I'm probably
We've got your IMDb, and one of the more recent things we see is Middlemost Post. That was for Nickelodeon as a rigger. And of course, very exciting for me as a, you know, a 90s nerd, the new Animaniacs, you were a rigger on that as well for Yowza.
I'm surprised that they have that information. You know, whenever we get those documents that get sent out for these shows, how do you want to have your name in the credits or how do you want to be known? I never fill them out and send them back in. So I know that like I don't know what shows are I'm listed on there, but
it's probably the producer or somebody, right, who goes sure and makes that everyone is credited on IMDb because it's pretty comprehensive.
I've never like put any information on there.
Someone's doing a good job on your behalf, I think. You've got, like, on the list, the latest is Thomas the Tank, or Thomas and Friends, which looks great, by the way. It's beautiful. I had a good look at it yesterday, and, the animation is so good.
I loved that show. Animating on it was a lot of fun, but I think that there was a little bit of planning that probably could have been done better, because when you have these a Toon Boom model, and you can imagine the amount of parts and deformers, if you ever watch the series, they are very complex rigs. And there's a lot of like acting that happens with the master controllers, and there's a lot of expression to the characters. But what would really take the most amount of time was getting believable perspective on the track for the very first pose. And once you got the very first pose set up, as long as it wasn't going over a hill or doing something really unusual. Usually there's a lot of like, you know, sit on the tracks and just kind of, you know, do some tilts and whatnot. Sometimes a jump and change the direction, because they can't change direction. So every time they had to leave the shot, they'd have to jump. But once you had the perspective done in the pose one, you could usually kind of use it for the whole scene. But, you know, there are times where you spend a good chunk of the day just getting all the pieces that look good in perspective so you can just start the scene.
And I can imagine that's like actually a real kind of unique problem for Thomas the Train, like, because, I mean, you can kind of cheat, you know, like the character on backgrounds usually, but because the train is just so attached to those tracks,
absolutely,
there's no cheating. Like, that just has to be right. You can, because like the human mind can see perspective without even knowing about it, and it can really see it when it's wrong.
Absolutely. And with there being so many things cut into so many things and so many layers on top of so many deformers, sometimes you have to turn all the deformers off to figure out which piece you're actually changing the shape on. And it was a challenge. I loved that show. You know, it's probably as far as animation, I enjoyed that. I enjoyed the most recent one I worked on too, the hamster show. But some of the other, you know, I did animation directing on Corn and Peg, and any of the scenes I realized, hey, you know what? Characters that fly are really difficult. It's really difficult to give believable hovers and believable flapping. And four-legged characters, when every character is four-legged, I don't want to be involved in another show where everyone's on four legs.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Twice as much to think about.
That's right.
In terms of a walk cycle.
They had like big heads on Corn and Peg. They had big heads and little bodies as well. So that's an extra
and
thing as well.
Legs
on top of that.
And
no hands as well.
No hands, exactly. So all those little things, like, you know, I there are certain moments in your life where you work on different shows that have different challenges. So like they had no hands. That was a real challenge. When I was animation director of Curious George, I did it in China. And one of the things, you know, you and I could listen to the kind of, you know, basically George does these noises, ooh, 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 you know, that kind of like monkey noise. And when you hear the dialogue of the man with the yellow hat, and you look at the storyboard expression and listen to the audio, it's very clear for English-speaking people to understand it, what the emotion is. But we were doing this show in China, and like the Chinese animators are hearing things. They're not hearing, you know, is the man in the yellow hat upset or happy? You know, how is and the storyboards, in some cases, were drawn very loose, and it was hard to understand. You know, it's hard to tell that it's George. They were so loose in some of the shots. And I remember thinking, right. Boy, it's hard to explain these little grunts to people that don't speak English.
And did you work on that remotely, or did you go to China to work on that?
I lived in China for 3 years, I guess.
Whoa, cool.
I lived in India for 3 years. I lived in South Africa for a year.
So have you got a bunch of different languages? Are you a polyglot?
No, like
one who knows many languages.
When you work in a studio in China, every animation director gets paired up with a translator. So the in-studio stuff is not so hard. But that's the only person you can really talk to, because none of the animators speak English. So you do a lot more acting. Like, you know, in Canada, if you're supervising and someone comes to your desk, you might just type out a note or just explain it. But for them, you know, I always think, well, even when I'm acting it, I'm speaking in English, and I probably just look silly to them, because they're only going to pick up so much of what I'm saying. And whenever I say something very, very briefly about like the attitude, the mannerism, the intention of the scene, I'll sit and listen to the translator say so much. And I'm thinking, what is she saying that's taking so much time? Are they talking about what they're going to do for lunch? And like, you know, how I'm thinking, wow, it's that, you know, the intention of this scene is, you know, for him to, you know, act surprised. And that little line might take like, 6 minutes of conversation. And I think, well, I didn't say that much. That seems like a lot of stuff was explained there. So,
but in 3 years, you must have picked up something.
Yeah, like, well, you have to, because, you know, when you get there, the first thing you realize is nobody else speaks English either. Like the people in the restaurants don't speak English, the taxi drivers.
Yeah.
So, you know, the first thing I started to learn is like, you know, the first thing I learned was Dan Chow Fan, egg fried rice. Because I knew that if I was hungry, everyone's going to have egg fried rice. And then, you know, eventually I started learning other dishes, Gung Pao Ji Ding and Beijing Koryo and a bunch of other types of dishes. And I could say, okay, now I can go to any different level of Chinese restaurant, and you know, of course, a whole bunch more, and I can order something. And then I realized, you know, I need to be able to speak to taxi drivers. So I started learning like simple, like, you know, it's a zhou. I mean, it's a zhou, go straight, zhou guai, go right, yo guai, go left, daola, I've arrived. And then it keeps growing as you kind of need. As like you realize, okay, now I need to learn this, and you know, the typical questions like, you know, where are you from, how much money do you make in Canada? They ask you very, very
right.
They ask you very, very like what's on their mind kind of questions.
Oh, that's kind of great to like to be immersed in a whole other culture like that.
Oh, I loved it,
and get paid for a job that you love at the same time.
Yeah, and in the old days, you know, it was a really, really, like, overseas animation supervisors, it was a great paying job. Like, I went to, I directed a series called Zero Man. It starred...
Leslie Nielsen.
We did a bit of research. Yeah. I was looking at your IMDb, and you've been in recent years, you've become a rigger and a supervisor and all this, but in your under director, it had Hose Hounds, which is a show about dogs who work in a fire station, Dalmatians.
Okay.
And then, of course, Zero Man, which, it had Leslie Nielsen, and I checked. It's Ryan Reynolds before he was known for anything. So,
And I directed, a show for the SABC called Magic Cellar, but most of this stuff has all been, low-budget television. You know, Zero Man had a fair budget, but it got me overseas. I got to the point where, we were finished storyboarding and the owner of the studio came to me and said, we don't have a very big budget for an overseas supervisor. Maybe you want to go and do that. Because in the old days, you used to ship hard drives back and forth from Asia. Like there was no FTP, there was no file sharing. So it was, you're supervising the animation, nowadays you can send files back and forth, but back then they were we'd have to wait for the whole line test of the show, come on the hard drive, make our calls, send it back again, and it wasn't very efficient. So the owner of the studio said, hey, why don't you go over there and be the animation supervisor? And and when I went over there, I realized I don't want to direct anymore. I don't want to, now I'm at a point I don't want to supervise anymore. I just want to do a job. Because I feel that when I was doing a Corn and Peg, there's a lot of deals that happen in animation where you just become the victim of it. And in this particular case, they sent the animation to go to another studio, and they made an interesting contract with that studio that you can only have two rounds of revisions, and then it had to come back to us to fix. Now, when you're in that situation where you can only have two rounds of revisions, and somebody gives you a scene that's really awful, well, the first round, you're just trying to iron out the big stuff. It's almost like you want to say, just give the scene to someone else because this person is not being able to handle it. So, but you can write a page of notes and send it off. The second time you're seeing it, it's better, but there's still a bunch of calls. And if they decide to do all the calls or one of the calls, they send it back to you again, and now it's your problem. So as an animation supervisor, I also had to do all of the animation retakes because I was the only person, only animator on that show. All the other animators were hired another studio to do the animation, and I would have to drive to that studio. Right. And that studio was maybe it took me about 2 hours to get there because of morning traffic and whatnot. And I would drive. Mm-hmm. I'd drive out there. I'd do the animation launch and, explain what we need and some of the more complicated shots. And we would just go through the show and I wouldn't see them again until the next animation launch. Everything was just done with retakes, written retakes. But then it got to the point where we were fixing everything. And when I thought about it, I thought, in my regular life, when I'm animating, I can usually have two to three different animation gigs going on at any time because, I'm at an age and stage of life that if you give me a quota of what should be 40 hours worth of work, I can probably do it in 25. And I can take a little bit of work here and there from other companies and make more than I would make as a supervisor. So when I went to work at Nelvana, I was working at Toon Boom, and Toon Boom and Nelvana are intertwined. They're both owned by Corus. And when I resigned from Toon Boom originally, it was because my son was coming to Canada to live with me. So there was no way I could travel anymore. That was during the days of travel. And when during my interview with Nelvana, they had seen that I had done all of these supervising and directing jobs and whatnot over the years. And they're like, they asked me what I wanted to do. And I'm like, I just want to animate and rig. Like, oh, we can offer you those jobs. We just weren't sure, you know, we thought you were coming in here wanting to be like a producer or something. But I wanted to have like, I just wanted to be on the floor. And I do find that it's when I'm faced with, I just finished the last 2 weeks I animated. I guess you guys have, I don't know, do you guys do Cartoon Forum and those trade shows?
This year we went to Annecy with a show that we're just start the show that in fact we learned Toon Boom for.
Oh, okay.
It's called Bad Jelly. It's based on a Spike Milligan book.
Okay.
And so we've been a Flash studio this whole time, but we really just wanted to kind of like up our game and like a lot of our funding has come from New Zealand, and we kind of, you know, there's only a limit to the amount of funding you can get here. So we kind of wanted to step up onto the world stage. And so with Bad Jelly, we went to Annecy with that one.
Okay.
I think the idea is that we've sort of pushed Flash as far as it can go, because the shows that we have produced with Flash, we think are pretty of a very high standard, like, better than what most, when people think of Flash animation for TV, we think we've done a step above that. But, you know, rather than constantly having to push against the limitations of the program and the budget of what local funding can offer, this is Mutt Putty's first step into the world of international funding and stepping into Toon Boom, which, just as a viewer, you can tell a Flash show from a Toon Boom show, and the Toon Boom show, you can just tell the program is able to do a lot more and produce a lot more variety in the results. In terms of you changing roles from being a director and a supervisor into stepping into rigging and training, it's interesting because, you know, a lot of young bucks think, I really want to be a director or whatever, because they're the person who gets to make the creative decisions. But being the animation supervisor, it sounds like it was a lot more solving other people's problems and correcting other people's work, and you would rather be doing the work yourself.
Yeah, and I did find, like, when I was directing, I started directing Hose Hound 6 months out of school. I graduated from Sheridan College. I had made a film called Creeps, which is the story of Dracula, Frankenstein, Wolfman, and Mummy Man living in modern day. And they just kind of fit in, because nowadays everyone is so colorful that they, you know, piercings and bones in their ear and everything else. Nobody really noticed there's anything unusual about them, except that because they are who they are, always their plans always fail. So the film that I made is Dracula convinces Frankenstein that he should throw a party at his castle, because he lives in the castle and his dad's a doctor, and it's going to be a great inn with the ladies. So they're at the party, and they're all sitting together with they're sitting together with each of them have a lady, and the girl is like, you know, playing with a cork on Frankenstein's neck, saying, you know, Dracula tells me your daddy's a doctor, and he gets so excited at this moment that his eye falls out because he's made up of spare parts. He's a Frankenstein monster, and the girls get freaked out and they leave. It's sort of like they always get close to their goals, but their physical, because of who they are, like, you know, the Wolfman goes to the theme park, and the girl would realize he's not
he's not just a hairy guy. He actually is a werewolf.
Yeah, exactly. Or you know, the Dracula isn't seen in the mirror. You know, he doesn't have a reflection.
Yeah.
So
is that short available to view anywhere?
No, I've so what happened with that short is I finished it as a work in progress. It did like the work in progress film festivals, and the people from MTV saw it, and they used to have this DVD called Cartoon Sushi, which were a whole bunch of short films they'd put on the DVD and they'd sell them. So they got in touch with me and they offered me a job. They said, okay, we would like you to come and work for us, but while you're waiting for your green card, you can come to New York and work on your film, and we will pay for the rights to your film. So we're not paying you. We're not doing anything that's...
You could be in Canada working this, you know, if you wanted to. They're just buying the product that you're making.
Exactly. So I, of course, was really excited by the idea. And I went back to Lacewood or Amberwood, the studio that was making a Hose Hounds. And I said, okay, I'm resigning. I'm going to give you my, like, you know, 4 weeks notice or whatever. And they were all okay with this. And one day the owner of the studio came to me and said, his name's Sheldon Wiseman. He came to me and said, hey, you just started and I understand you're leaving the company. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to go finish my student film in New York for MTV. And then they're going to put me on development for this series called, I think the working title was Big Top. And it was, I think it was circus performers by night and like superheroes by day or something like that. I don't really remember the whole gist of it. And also 6 months out of school being offered a development job, being able to make your own film, of course I would leave this job. And the owner of the studio came to me and said, well, can you show me what this film is? So the next day I brought in my VHS tape and put it in the TV. And you know, he's a lawyer first and a businessman second. So he just looked at it almost with a face where I'm like, oh my God, he hates this film. Didn't laugh at any of the jokes. I didn't make a sound for the whole film.
Yeah.
I'm just sweating. I'm like, oh my God, he thinks I'm an outcast or something. And he turned to me and he's like, okay, how would you feel about staying working for us? I'll give you a $50,000 development deal. I will buy this and I'll buy the rights so I can pitch this as a series for a year. And after a year, the rights revert back to you, but you know, of course, you get to keep the money. You can do what you were going to be doing anyway. You could work on this film, but instead of finishing the film, I want you to put together a Bible and a pitch pack. And I'm so confident in you that the next series that we do, you're going to direct it. And I was like, okay. So I went off and I put together this package and this all of this stuff. And at that point, I didn't even really know what a pitch pack was. I didn't really know, like, you know, he'd come back from MIP and he'd show us these one sheets. So I was familiar with what a one sheet looked like. It was like a little poster, and you guys have seen one sheets before. But like to put together this whole package by myself, and again, 6 months out of school, I don't have, like, you know, I don't have a lot of exposure. And I put together.
And I was gonna say, this is a film that isn't quite complete yet, and they're already asking you, hey, can you turn this into can you envision this as an entire series? It's quite a challenge to throw at someone fresh out of studying.
Exactly. I had to come up with springboards, not outlines. I had to come up with all of the character descriptions and everything. It was kind of a big job for me, and like, you know, I don't think that writing is my forte. I think that, you know, I can do it. I can see what's wrong with something more than I can do it myself. So I put together this package, and it was a big hit, and you know, it went around to all the markets, and I kept getting the kind of feedback. It's not how is it put to me? It's not if this will sell, it's when it will sell. And, you know, time passed and the rights reverted back to me. And, you know, he came to me one day. He's like, well, we couldn't sell it. But, you know, and this is actually probably, you know, I think the timeline was maybe like 4 months later, we were finishing up season one of Hose Hounds. And it was going to the markets, and he had like a bit of a buzz about him. And then season two came along, and he's like, okay, so, you know, you're directing it. And I went to him and said, okay, but can I have a co-director? And I got one of my classmates from school, Chris Roy, to co-direct the episodes, because they were both 11 minutes long, and I would do one 11 and he would do the other 11, but we would
Oh, that's cool.
So I directed like 8 seasons of that or 7 seasons of that.
Yeah, wow. Like 57 episodes or something.
I know it was a lot, whatever it was. I think the last season I also went overseas and supervised the animation. And then I went on to Zero Man and I did that. It was really unfortunate because I don't think it was exactly right at that time. I think that after a couple of seasons, we probably could have got to be quite funny. Because there was even more stars. Kevin McDonald was in that.
That's right.
We were just looking at
Kids in the Hall
page. Of course, he went on to a really, really fruitful voice acting career. A very funny sketch actor.
Yeah, he's in Lilo and Stitch, right? He's the
one-eyed green alien, Mr. Pleakley. He's also one of the alien leaders, the tallest from Invader Zim. He's in a lot of stuff. He's got a great voice for it. I could definitely see a lot of potential in Zero Man, but it only went one season.
It went one season because, and I'm not going to make excuses for it, but you know, the biggest thing in Canada is hockey night in Canada. Saturday night, 7 o'clock, you know, everyone's at home and they watch, you know, their local teams play. Now, the year that Zero Man came out, it was put on, Hockey Night in Canada starts at 7:30, and they aired Zero Man primetime on Teletoon, 7 o'clock Saturday night. That year, hockey went on strike. And people started getting out of the house more, going out more. You know, they weren't staying home and watching. And I believe because two of the main commentators from Hockey Night in Canada were the henchmen, Don Cherry and Ron McLean. There was a lot of ingredients for it to be, you know, whoever we wanted them to go after for voice talent. You know, they gave us a wish list of actors that we wanted, and we got most of the people that we wanted, you know. And
I can see how you guys might have thought reasonably this could actually work out in our favor, because the hockey is gone. What else are people going to watch? Yeah. This is a show aimed at adults, and it's even got some of Canada's premier...
Don Cherry, right? Commentator.
Hey, if you want your fix of Don Cherry...
Coach's Corner. Yeah, he was... And he did... He was a... because although the series was based out of Ottawa, which is about 7 hours away, I would go to some of the record sessions in Toronto, and... you know, he's a pretty, you know, big figure, not in stature, but in kind of notoriety. And he also, and you know, God love him, and whatever I say is just the, you know, telling stories of the days of. But he always made me feel, although he was he agreed to do the show, he kind of always made me feel like it was just getting in his way of his normal life.
Doing a cartoon was beneath him.
Well, it wasn't necessarily beneath him, but it was just like, I you know, why did I do this? You know, he'd come and you'd explain to him, like, you know, in this particular instance, the point of this line is we need, you know, the accent to be this particular word, and because later in the script they're going to say something, and we want to make sure that the audience catches, etc. And he'd read it completely upside down or backwards, you know, like, and you think, oh, okay, well, we're going to have to ask for another take. And you know, usually he'd get into you know, most of Hockey Night in Canada is kind of like what we're doing now, just a conversation about hockey. If he had to do commercial work, like, I think one day he got quite mad at me. He's like, you know, I just did an ad for Subway sandwiches. I did it in a single take, and I got $200,000 for doing it or something. He made some sort of comment like that. Right. I'm like, oh, yeah, I know, but this has to be done a specific way. But the great thing is the other thing about him is he always wanted to be in the booth with Ron McLean. Ron McLean, who was his partner on Hockey Night in Canada, so they could read their lines together, or Ron could read Kevin McDonald's lines, and because they would always show up together, so he would hear the line and know how to react to it.
So they, yeah, they'd kind of feed off each other. That's what they were used to doing.
Exactly. And there was a time where I could feel a blow up coming, you know, because he didn't say something quite right. And then Ron McClane's like, you know what, Doug, you know, besides that, you know, I ruffled my papers while you were saying your line. And I think you guys caught that too. And I was like, oh, he's saving me now. He's like, you know, because it's getting to a point where, you know, you can only ask for so many takes before he's going to, you know, just walk out. But then at the end, after the 13 episodes, because he wasn't invoicing any week, he all the money went to his favorite charity. So at the end of the day, when you have this kind of like these sessions where you're like, oh, it's, you know, it's really hard to work with him. Maybe next season, if there's a next season, we could have different henchmen. Maybe every, you know, the henchman at the end of the season fails. So Rusty's, maybe it's a reoccurring gag. There's always new henchmen. We could always get more interesting people. Maybe we can get a hockey player next time. Maybe we can get, you know, something different. But gave it all to charity. So
it's crazy because, you know, even for Don Cherry, I mean, the character that he was playing looks like him.
Oh, you know, all he had to do was be himself. But I think he was.
That's right. But isn't that an honor to be like to have like your likeness in a cartoon? I don't know. I think it's pretty cool.
And well, that's the thing is he says about, you know, doing a commercial and he gets paid a lot. That's great, but like, I don't know, when you're doing an animated comedy, you really need them to be reading the lines exactly the way that you need them. Yeah, otherwise,
you're not selling sandwiches.
Exactly. And this is kind of apropos of nothing. It reminds me of a story that Maurice LaMarche, who's a very famous voice actor and impressionist, he's sort of the premier William Shatner impressionist, and he loves finding behind-the-scenes stories about actors behaving badly. Of course, he does Orson Welles, and Orson Welles is infamous for having behind-the-scenes blow-ups. But William Shatner on Star Trek was asked to retake a line because of his accent.
Red alert. All hands stand to battle stations.
He was reading a line, and he would say, "Mr. Spock, sabotage the system." And the director said, "Can you retake that? In America, we don't say sabotage. We need you to say sabotage." And he snapped back at him, "You say sabotage. I say sabotage." Sometimes you get actors like that. They will not be told that this is how we need you to say it. As Orson Welles once said, the correct reading is the one I'm giving.
Yeah, true. I did a little something with William Shatner several years ago. We did some sort of promotional thing with Toon Boom where I think it was if you made a short film using his audio track or something, you could win something. I can't remember what it was. So I did a sample one and I think from what I remember, he may have came to the studio and I think there was a whole bunch of rules. You know, you weren't allowed to talk to him. You weren't allowed to look at him. I feel like or people met him somewhere. I know I wasn't part of the meet and greet, but I was part of the phone calls with him to organize this little movie. I don't think it really went anywhere.
Right? Oh, what a shame. We love William Shatner on this show.
Know that we love William Shatner.
Maybe we love Captain Kirk. Okay. Maybe that's all it is.
And I have heard he's often a challenge to work with. Though he's a personality. I do think about it from the point of view of he must have people recognize him every place that he goes. So it might sound alien to us, you know, a writer saying please don't talk to Mr. Shatner, but like. If they didn't have that in their contract, I bet you every second God sends, he would have someone coming up to him going, "By the way, I just wanted to tell you, I love Star Trek," you know, I know you're from Boston Legal or whatever.
It's also possible that he doesn't know that his people are doing that.
Well, exactly.
I did hear a story of Eddie Murphy, and you know, before Eddie Murphy turns up on set, his people say, "Don't look at Eddie, don't talk to Eddie, don't do this, don't do that," and then Eddie showed up. And was really nice.
Okay.
And really personable.
And for all he knows, might be like, why is nobody talking?
Yeah. And everybody's nervous around him, you know? And it's like, that's kind of unfortunate for poor Eddie Murphy. I wanted to just say, though, Zero Man was before you were with Toon Boom. Was that traditionally animated?
It looks like
it. It was hand-drawn traditionally. It was... half of the episodes were done in a studio in the Philippines called Toon City. and the other half were done in Suzhou, China with Wang Film.
Wang are one of the premier outsourcing studios. You know, they've worked on things like Batman, the animated series, a whole bunch of really big stuff in the 90s. Zero Man, the episode that I looked at, it was very lushly animated. Like, it moved beautifully. There were no, it didn't look like any corners cut. And it looked to me, you might be able to confirm, digitally inked and colored. And like, there were these nice shadows on the characters that, you know, for cell animation would be expensive. Usually cell shows are, the characters are totally painted flat, but with a digital show, you can add little details like that.
Yeah, it was done on paper and it was scanned, and you know, they did the paint line and they did the frame by frame painting. But yeah, it was all hand drawn. It was Wang has two divisions. They have the Taipei division, which I think more of the high-end stuff was always going to Taipei. And then they had China, which was more of the, lower budget stuff. And they would do a lot of the overflow work. And, the crazy thing was when I went there is after I left Zero Man, left Amberwood because I moved to Toronto after that series. I started working at, how did this work? The timeline that's mixed up. I worked on a series called...
You've had a very long career. There's a lot going on.
Yeah, you've done a lot of things as well.
Well, I remember losing... No, it was in between like Zero Man and Hose Hounds. There was a time where I went back to Toronto to animate on a series called Sticking Around. Sticking Around is the stick person character.
You may be shocked to know that's on your IMDb too.
Oh, yeah. So maybe a lot of stuff's there. Is Final Space on there?
Final Space? Actually, I don't know if that is. No, I didn't see it. What did you do on Final Space? Because that's a fairly popular Netflix show.
I did rigging on that for Yowza, and I loved the designs and stuff like that. But I we're talking about Sticking Around.
This was just between two directing jobs. You stepped back into animation for a job.
I stepped back into animation, and it was kind of weird because we worked on that season. I think it was season two or season three. We all got called at the end of the season to come and get our pictures taken with won a Gemini Award, which is some award here in Canada for programming. I guess it's the Canadian Emmy, if you will. And while we were there, we were all told we're being laid off, and the animation is going overseas the next season.
Whoa.
So I moved back to Ottawa. I started directing Zero Man. And at the end of the show, I mentioned that I went overseas to supervise it. And when I got to the studio in China, I get a tour of the studio to see what they're working on. And they indeed were working on Sticking Around. And I thought, well, I lost my job and I found myself in the same studio that took my job.
Yeah. It's like the Godfather. Just when you think you're out, they drag you back in again.
Yeah, hey, guess what? You're sticking around.
Yeah, exactly. But the studio actually didn't take advantage of me at all and ask me anything about the show.
They were like, hey, it's Stick Figures. We got it.
Yeah, I guess so. The amazing thing about the Chinese artists, especially the Chinese cleanup artists, is when you watch them, they are so precise on their work. They can maintain a pencil thickness all day. You know, they have like this very nice touch. They can go over it. You know, they don't do a lot of fancy tapers and thick and thins, but they can make a really good, almost like a bent coat hanger kind of line. Like, it's just nice. Perfectly the same thickness all day long.
I guess that's a skill that's kind of disappearing now with digital animation.
Oh god, if we ever went back to the hand drawing, our model would be awful,
all over the place, right? Yeah, so what was it like when Toon Boom came along, when it came into your life? Like, how did that change things?
Well, I think it was my time on Curious George was, and working in India, I decided that I needed a break. 3 years of India is difficult for anyone. And so I went to the studio and I said, hey, you know, my contract's up in 2 weeks. Before I sign a new contract to stay on, I would like to go home. Mm-hmm. And at least for a couple of weeks, and you know, that was met with but we're in the middle of production, and I, you know, I understood, yes, you're in the middle of production, but when you give somebody a 1 year contract, then you know at the end of the year, that's the time where you can negotiate these things. You know, you have to, it has to be fair both ways. For 365 days, yeah, I'll do the long hours. I'll work the overnight shifts. I'll get the work out. But at the end of the year, this is where we have to decide. Like, you know, do we want to keep working together? Because you know, the artist and studio relationship is, the studio always can get rid of you anytime they want. But you don't get to choose where and what you're working on. And I knew that, like, you know, I needed, you know, I wanted to come home for a couple of weeks, and it went back and forth, and it was kind of getting to a point where I realized, you know, well, if I'm going to go home, I'm not even expecting, you know, I'll pay for my own flight. I'll cover the costs of it, because you know, I can't expect them to pay for it, even though it was discussed in my contract, two-way tickets, for the contract. And I could see that they were, I think they bought like 5 years, they did like 5 years back to back. There was never going to be a good time to go home.
Right.
And so I on the 365th day, I bought my ticket. I dropped off my key to my flat, and I flew home. And I decided that I would go back to school and study 3D animation. And a very good friend of mine was working at Mercury Filmworks at the time as a supervisor. And he said, why don't you come work here? You're too old to learn 3D. All these young kids are willing to put way more hours in than you. Why don't you come and work at Mercury and do animation? I think we were doing... one of the very first animated series was called, it was Mischief City, which was, I think, Mercury's very first animated cutout Toon Boom show. So I worked on that. And at that time, Harmony was very, very different and very unpredictable. And more often than not, you know, you'd lose your day's worth of work.
Wow.
Well, you kind of ended up doing, you know, not exactly what you'd thought. You know, you thought you were going to go and learn computer animation because there's so many opportunities there, rather than, you know, the laborious travel and, you know, physical busy work of analog animation. But it turns out Toon Boom was the perfect in between, because it is a digital program that was really, you know, I guess you kind of know, but it was about to change the industry. And it meant you didn't have to do as much travel.
At that time, I didn't know. I didn't know that, like, you know, because at that time, it wasn't like Toon Boom was, you know, maybe, well, actually at that time, it was an ink and paint software that was entering into digital animation. You know, they had the very, it was actually not even called Harmony then. It was called Concerto. And we had a couple of people at Mercury that were helping develop the software and from Toon Boom. And at Nelvana, they were doing their first show. And I that may have been 16. I can't remember which show it was. And they were developing a different version called Symphony. So we had Concerto, they had Symphony. And at the end of, I think, the season, they looked at both products that were created, and they liked the one that was developed for Nelvana more than they liked the one that was being developed at Mercury. And I think it was packaged up. It was called Symphony, and there was some other digital music software called Symphony, so it got named something else. It got named Harmony, and that's the software that we have today. But I used like almost another version that could have been the version that went worldwide, called Concerto, in the beginning at Mercury. And I did a couple of shows there. And then I found myself, I think, living in Africa, directing a 3D series because I found a, you know, I still hadn't realized that I don't enjoy directing. I enjoy just being on the floor. I was telling you maybe before the break that over the last couple of weeks, when I was mentioning this cartoon market, we one of the consulting things we do is, if you want to, you know, proof of concept video or anything, we will animate it and do it for you. So I've been actually doing something for one of the European customers that we have, animating a short 3-minute or a 90-second film. And what's great about it is, these 2 weeks that went by, it was a very short deadline to animate 90 seconds of a character that's new. Like, you know, as any time you start a show, you're a little slow at the beginning because you have to kind of figure out who the character is and how to move them the best and how to work with them. And, you know, it was amazing how quickly 2 weeks went by when you're doing the work. Mm. When you're doing other stuff, you know, like service requests and filling out, like, you know, post-training documentation, I feel like the day is so long.
yeah. That's not your favorite part of the job, right?
Yeah, like when you're actually doing the work, if you have a rig to build or you have animation to do, the job goes by very, very quickly.
You just get lost in it, really.
You do, and especially when you know, if the way I work is I work and I listen to, you know, maybe a show on Netflix. I'm like, okay, this 45-minute show, by the time it's done, I want to have, you know, this character posed out. And I almost use these like episodes as, okay, so because I want to listen to the episode while it's going on, because I don't watch anything, I just listen. And I do find myself like not ever getting as far as I want to, because I can say, oh man, it's already over and I haven't got that far. But the time went by so quickly. Like, you never looked at the clock until you realize, oh, it's lunchtime and I'm not as far along as I hoped I'd be. So
I think that's one of the big stresses of being an animator, is when you get to the end of the day and you look at your work and, like, you've been working hard all day, but there's just such a little amount done. It's like, where did the day go? And how am I going to get this done by the end of the week?
Yeah, no, I do. But you know, you always do, because I feel like we can work at a certain pace when there's less pressure, and we can work at an incredible, like, people that have been in the industry long enough, you can do amazing things at crunch time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel that I can. Like, if I have three things that all have a deadline on the same day, somehow I get all three of them done.
The heavy lifting often happens at the start. That's right. You've got to do it seems to be coming together very slowly as you're posing out the scene, you're planning what's going to happen, you're solving all the problems. And then it's sort of a roll downhill toward the end where you're just, applying lip sync, doing a little bit of secondary animation. And it comes together very quickly because you're right. You never know how it's going to get done in time. And yet the deadlines seem to be met.
It's true. There is a lot of heavy lifting at the beginning.
I think as well with the digital animation, because, you know, you kind of, every animator works on their own scene. You kind of, the scene gets filled to the time that you have to fill it. You know, like if you've got like 2 days to do a scene, you know, you get your basics in first. And then if you find yourself with an extra half day, that's when you sort of go in and really kind of like finesse it and clean it up and add extra little bits here and there.
I 100%.
just listening to you having talked about your career, sort of the breadth of it, it seems to me you've done, you know, you've done it in a really smart way where, you know, studying at Sheridan, you made a film to show what you could do. That led to an opportunity to potentially pitch a series. And when that didn't happen, you directed. And it sounds like you weren't even necessarily hoping or even thinking about doing a series or becoming a director. But you always say yes to the opportunities that come your way. And by doing that, you know, you've done so many things, worn so many different hats. And it seems like what you're saying is that now that you're stepping into the role of rigging and what you're doing now, you've really discovered exactly what it is that you like doing in animation.
I think so. Like I'd rather be like a spoke in the wheel than a pillar. And I find that, like, you know, maybe because the age and stage of my life, I was very fortunate to have good jobs when I was young and make good money when I was young. Like, you know, a lot of people in the early days of animation when I was directing, a lot of my friends were only working like 16 weeks of the year doing layout. And then once layout was done, you know, they waited for the next thing to come along. And back then I was also doing layout and posing. I wasn't just, you know, the most important thing that, you know, you should remember, I think, in this industry is you don't have to be the best at anything, but be able to do everything a little bit so that you're useful within a studio. Maybe working in smaller studios are good because you have to work, you have to wear a lot of hats. Where in a bigger studio, you know, you can easily just be, you know, have one job that people only think of you for that one job, and they don't consider, hey, we have a layout, maybe we can give it to that guy, because the studio is so big, it's really hard for people to know what your strengths are. So maybe you know, the advice I'd give to somebody young getting in is work in small studios, and then you're forced to have to wear a ton of hats. And that's what I did. I worked you know, before these Amberwood and the studios where I was directing, they were small studios. We, you know, as a director, we were also editing our own shows. We were doing everything ourselves. We, you know, we were voice directing, you know, celebrities at a very young age. You know, that's unheard of now.
Yeah, it's a really good opportunity. And I think I agree with you. I think it's great advice.
Which is try a little bit of everything, because you don't have to be the greatest, but you'll get your hands wet. I mean, Muck Buddy's a pretty good example. We're up until recently, we've been about 40, 45 people strong. And whenever something needs doing, they just sort of ask, who's interested? There's not as much animation that needs doing at the moment. So a bunch of animators have stepped into the storyboarding role, which is a completely different part of the process, but it comes directly before ours. So it never hurts to understand, well, what goes into that? How do you plan for animation to make, you know, these two different jobs work together seamlessly?
Absolutely. Well, you think about the compositor. How many like, you know, days of the year do you need like a full-time compositor? But if the compositor is also like, you know, someone who could rig or do scene setup or any of those tasks, you know, there's always an opportunity for them to move around the studio.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I just wanted to circle back because I didn't get to ask about it, but I watched all of the new Animaniacs just as a fan, and you were a rigger on that show, and it seems like quite a challenge, because that show's, you know, it was done in the old way, which is cells and drawn on paper, and was deliberately calling back to like the theatrical shorts of the 40s. It had a very specific look, and taking that and translating it to a digital program and building rigs that are capable of doing all the necessary acting and action and stretching and whatnot that those characters needed to do. Was that challenging, or was it just another job?
Well, it was a little bit of it was a little strange, the rigging on that show, because all the rigs were based on almost action poses. So whatever pose, the most important pose and maybe a scene that somebody thought was going to be necessary, that would get rigged. So, you know, one of the examples, there was one character I had to build that it was Pinky and the Brain, and they were sort of combined somehow. Do you remember an episode where they were?
I do. They step into a, you know, it's a The Fly situation. They get their DNA gets combined, and the brain is very frustrated because he's literally attached at the hip to Pinky.
And they had probably, I'm going to say 25 to 30 views that they want to have built. And the interesting thing about that studio is if you do one build or 25 builds, you get the same. It's by the piece. So a rig is a piece. So if you put a peg on a dot, you'd get a rate. It'd be the same rate if you had 25 views of the character. Dang. It's paid for a rig.
That's what I've heard about Steven Spielberg Productions, because he's produced a lot of animated shows, and he's insistent on, we don't cut corners. Like, I want, you know, beautiful, complicated camera work. Whatever the director wants to make this as strong as possible, it's going in, and it's the animators and artists' jobs to just figure it out. So not an easy taskmaster.
Yeah, and I remember that one, and probably, you know, that one was tough because in reality, there's 25 views and you're rigging both characters in every view. And you're doing it on one timeline. There's a certain amount of work that, you know, when they're not all like straight armed characters, every pose has like, you know, the different arms. So you're creating like, you know, new pivots and moving the pivot over and then doing the drawing. And it was like a real long process to build those. And they look so easy, you know, the Animaniacs, they look pretty easy, but the fact is they never wanted you to use, like, you know, articulating round jointed arms. So they wanted it to look like the pose, and then the artist would have to perhaps do a bunch of drawing substitutions of the lower arm and where the elbow is, and that just makes it feel like it's 2D hand drawn.
Yeah, it definitely looked it, and you could tell that's what they were striving for, and I think you pulled it off. It does not look like a jointed, rigged show, even though it is.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, I hardly watch any of the stuff that I work on, so I haven't seen even a single frame of it.
Yeah, that's the thing about when you work in animation, watching your own stuff kind of feels like you're at work.
Yeah, yeah. Well, also it's sometimes I like, you know, when you work on something and you get, you know, your batch of scenes and they're from like episode 26B, you may not learn the name of the episode, and you'd have to watch, you know, you have to scrub through the whole season to find out where your scenes are. So I never remember the episodes. I'll be honest, I love working in it, but I don't watch much of it.
Yeah, I think that's probably more common than you think. There's a lot of people at this studio who they're not particularly interested in enjoying animation recreationally. It's what they do.
Yeah, like I'd rather watch like Primal or someone else's stuff.
Sure.
Something I know nothing about, something I just want to watch for entertainment.
Yeah.
Than watching things that I worked on. Like I've never watched a whole Thomas episode, but I've, you know, when maybe I'm faced with a task of, you know, Thomas is doing something, I might want to scrub through an episode to see, hey, how has someone else handled that action or that kind of thing? So you kind of watch the episodes, the previous ones, to see what someone else did, and then you know, but you're not really watching it for content. Yeah. You're scrubbing through it.
A technical exercise, appreciating the work that you and other people put into this program.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
I just wanted to share a little bit about how my Toon Boom journey is going, because other students might feel differently, but I feel like I was one of the students who found it the most challenging. I've been using Flash since I was about 12, and it's really deeply ingrained. So learning a new program for the first time in, you know, decades, since before puberty, it was a big change. And there are definitely times in the class where I was having trouble keeping up, and even points where I just watch what you and other people were doing, because if I was trying to do it myself, particularly with the rigging, which isn't what my department is, I'd get a little lost. So I just watched what was happening and went, okay, I know I'll be able to figure this out later. And big props to Taya, one of our animators, who actually took all of your videos, which we recorded all of the training sessions. They've actually gone through and time indexed all the topics and at what point we discuss them. So now they're actually really useful resources.
Wow.
Now that I'm actually using it. And I was a little worried that maybe I wouldn't be up to scratch with the other animators, but we've had a couple weeks to really get to grips with Toon Boom and play with it. And so I've been working on short little projects and just taking baby steps. Like the first thing I did was just like, you know, an establishing shot, which is just a drawing. So teaching myself how to draw in Toon Boom, because it is different than Flash. And sure enough, little by little, I'm figuring it out because I remember what you taught us. And if there's something I can't quite remember what the shortcut is, I can go and I can lean over and talk to Mike or someone else in the studio who is a little further ahead, but they're helping me catch up. So being in the studio together is really helpful. And people have noticed they'll often just hear a little ooh come from my corner of the office because I'm figuring out how to do something and I'm getting excited about this is going to save me so much time when I'm animating, you know? Mm. So it's I can say that I think all of us really got a lot of value out of the training.
Great. Well, I feel that the training is in some cases what you said is what I kind of tell people when they're getting stuck. Sometimes being a part of it and seeing somebody else do it tells you that it can be done. Even exactly. If you can't figure it out, if you can't figure out what a cutter does, when you're during the training, you're getting frustrated, you can't figure out how they hook them up. You know that they work. You saw how they worked, and eventually that moment's going to be like, oh, that little ooh sound that you made, or the ooh, I got it. That's now I can picture myself solving other problems because now it makes sense to me.
Absolutely.
The training is partially just seeing that it can be done and partially trying it yourself.
Yes, yeah. I know what it does, and I will figure out exactly – I'll figure out the how when I need to use it, which is what has been happening, and it's been great.
Yeah, it's like a lot of the time – you'd said it in the lesson as well. Harmony does all these different things, but it kind of does them the same way. You know, like, and once you kind of get your head around what nodes are doing, then you can even start to play around with nodes that you don't know. Yeah, there's so much repetition, and that you kind of quite quickly get comfortable with it.
Like, I'll be honest, I no matter how many times we went through it in the training, I just could not remember which part of the cutter node that I needed to hook which part into. But now that I'm building something myself and I know I want this to cut into this shape, I just Googled it or looked at the video that Taya had indexed and I went, oh, it's actually very easy.
Yeah.
And once you've committed it to memory by doing it, hey, it's under your belt.
It's still a real buzz when it happens as well.
Yeah.
It does, when it actually works. Yeah. And you're like, oh boy, how could I struggle with that for so long? And it's really not that hard. And then once you've done it four or five times, you realize you're never going to forget. And I always tell people, it's not that it's hard, because a lot of people will say it's hard, especially converting Flash studios like you guys. You have bad habits.
Mm.
Not bad habits. You have your own habits that like you have to break as well. You know, there's certain things. And, that you do, you're zooming in, you have buttons that you're constantly pressing to zoom, that one and two feels awkward in the beginning. And eventually, your hand just does it and you don't think about it.
That's right. And that's where you want to get it. It's like fluency.
Mm.
So that so you're not really thinking about the software. You're just thinking about your scene.
It's a little bit like going to a totally new country where you don't speak the language and you pick up the, which way to the beach can I get egg fried rice? Once you've got those basics down, if you wished, you could eventually immerse yourself and learn everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because, there are times where I may not understand Mandarin, but I can tell what the people are talking about. You know, I can tell that it might be about food or about numbers or about banking or about the person. Or I get enough words where I'm like, okay, I kind of tell what they're talking about, but I don't know it that well. I just know how to ask for certain things that I need and reply to certain questions and tell people how I'm feeling and what I need and et cetera. But far from it can I speak it.
With Toon Boom, though, like you said, when you started, it was quite a different program. Like, now you've kind of been there for all the updates. Is it hard sometimes when a big update comes in and you got to figure it out? Or is it just like, you know, because you know so much about the program, this is just each update is just a small thing that you barely even know that it's happened. Like, that's where I'm only asking that because that's where I'm with Flash. Whenever they updated Flash, it didn't change my workflow that much, but it seemed that Toon Boom changed quite a bit.
And I will say, one of the reasons that we've moved to Toon Boom is Toon Boom is so much more responsive as a support team. When you have an issue and you reach out, they will respond and help you. Whereas Flash, you know, Adobe is such a big company with such a suite of products, you might as well be, you know, talking to a wall sometimes. And when the updates happen, it seems to me, you know, I'm talking trash about the program that has done us well
changed
for many
our lives.
Years.
Yeah.
But it seems like the problems that we routinely have with Flash never actually get solved. Whereas from what I've heard from people who use Toon Boom, they say, yes, every update that Toon Boom does, they're addressing something that people have asked them to address. So I'm excited.
Yeah, that's very true. Like, you know, when Klaus was being made, you know, our brushes got better. But they were developing the brush like for the Klaus, and then they just added it to the next release.
Right.
So it was it's something that's happening or whatever tool. If, you know, I don't know if, you know, animated mats were something they needed in Klaus, or some customer needed it, and they get developed and then they get used. I mean, they become part of the software because there's no sense in developing a new tool that nobody needs. We will usually find out what the industry needs and work with a studio. Like, Master Controllers came out of Pose Copier for Mercury. They had this way of working with copying, and now Master Controllers is like the result of that.
Do you have back and forth with Harmony then? Like, will they come to you and sort of say, what do you need? Or like, how does that work?
We will sometimes make suggestions, let's say the professional services team. Like, you know, for instance, now I don't know when we were together exactly how I taught you how to do certain things, because certain things I go by the book, and there's certain things that I do. I show, you know, a technique maybe I do in the industry. And when you do timing, did I show you to use the ease editor and put the keyframes on twos? Or was I doing frame pulling, like count the number of frames and pull them over, grab a keyframe and pull it?
We did both, actually. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And that frame pulling, that, like, I do that in Flash as well. So that was familiar to me.
So what I wish you could do is, you know, I wish there was a way when you put your two keyframes beside each other, instead of having to shift plus like seven times, just a dialogue window pops up and it's like, push frames, seven frames, and then just it moves over. And then, like, you know, some way to automate that frame pulling so that, like, you can choose which side and it will just, it'll do the exact same kind of tweening. So, there's sometimes I have these ideas in my head like that, and I haven't actually pitched this to anyone in development, but every now and again, someone will be like, well, I have a particular workflow that I do. And I remember when, you know, I can only speak from the days where we were all in the same office, and sometimes you'd get the developer will say, well, who asked for that? And you say, no, it's just an idea I had. Oh, well, you know, we got to focus on what the customers want. And I think, well, but I'm kind of a customer too. Yeah, but a lot of times we are developing things because, you know, they do respond to what's needed.
That's
and,
cool.
We do, like, you know, we get our support tickets assigned to us each day. And within reason, we try to answer everyone, you know, within 24 or 48 hours at the most.
Fantastic.
You know, sometimes you get late on a Friday and, you know, you're doing a training or something and you think, I'll do the support ticket early next week. And sometimes they get put off, but most of the time we're we're encouraged to stay on top of them, because that the feedback that you gave is true. Like we do get back to people when they have a question.
I just wanted to ask quickly if you're able to talk briefly about, are you allowed to talk about the film that you that you're working on at the moment, or maybe just finished working on, Esahar, is that right?
Oh, so Esahar is actually in festivals right now. That was one that I did. I'm currently on a new film called The Tamarind Tree. And what that is it's every year there's the emir of Qatar's wife runs a film institute in the Middle East, and in the old days I'd go there and meet the filmmakers, we'd do the scripting and everything together, but now we're doing a lot more remote, and My job is to take a first-time filmmaker through the process of making a film. Emsahar, which is the most recent film, was I would work with them on the story, and I'd work with them on the storyboard, and I'd help them plan their shots, and then when the animation comes in, I teach them how to call retakes, and you take them through the whole process, so they may not really get their hands dirty, they certainly get the experience of being a filmmaker, and that film, and I don't know if you were joking that you teared up for it, but I have had some like good feedback where, you know, I played it in Italy for my students when I was and you know the girls got teary. They definitely and my girlfriend who likes to cry, she cried when she saw it. I think I'm too close to it for me to be emotionally impacted by it at all. But that one was a special one because the designer is a first time designer on a film. He is a graduate of Gobelin, and they wanted us to find somebody from Gobelin to work with because they also, or you know, the idea is for everyone to learn something from this. So he was a recent graduate, so that was nice. The animation studio was the animators were from India, I'm glad you liked it. It's a little story with a lot of heart.
It was really, really like you say, it had a lot of heart. It was a lovely story, and like your girlfriend, I tear up real easy. I cry easy.
My job is a filmmaking mentor, but I don't want to take away from the guys that actually filmmakers.
Once again, you were credited as animation supervisor, but you know that's a general term for what you did on the film. You were a mentor,
yeah.
But
as well as it being a nice story, though, when I was looking at it, and we kind of talked about this a little earlier on. When you look at animation, you wonder, how do they do that? And technically, it was amazing. All those light effects that were happening and the color effects, just beautiful.
The very first shot is just you see a pair of feet in a nightgown walking towards a door, and it moves so much like traditional animation. Yeah. That's what Harmony does. It blurs the line between traditional and digital animation.
Yeah, I think because there's a lot more textured lines, and there's a lot with deformers. You can put a lot more imperfection, or a lot more movement and shapes. So it really kind of. It does have a bit more of a 2D feel to it, but I'm glad you liked it. I thought I'd show you guys, and it's a point of conversation. But yeah, I make a film every year with a first time filmmaker, and it's a lot of fun. Some of the filmmakers do a lot less than others, but we always get them done.
Yeah, Esahar was a fantastic first effort. Is that publicly available? Is that link you sent us available for anyone to see, or
if you want to share it, not broadcast it, but yeah, you can share it amongst other people, and if you think they would like to see it, it wouldn't be a problem. It's already done the festival circuit, so
okay, fantastic. Well, we've got just under 3 minutes left of our Zoom call. Zoom, you know, it wants to get your money out of you if you can, but we're cheapskates. We do everything by not paying. So hey, we want to thank you for taking time out of your evening to chat with us. It's been fascinating.
Great. Well, thank you for having me. It's my first podcast, so I now know what it's all about. It's just a conversation.
That's all it is. And yeah, you did fantastic. You had no trouble, no end of stories to share with us. Probably even more. So if you ever want to come back, or you have something you want to promote or chat with us about, feel free to reach out.
Okay. Well, yeah. Thank you very much for the offer. If there's a time where you want to do another one of these, I'm sure I have tons of road stories about animation that would interest some of the listeners.
Absolutely, we'd love to hear them. And yeah, but really appreciate you coming on and chit-chatting with us, and also for teaching us how to use Toon Boom.
That too. Great job.
It's a thing I've wanted to do for years, because you know I've been Flash. My whole animation career has been Flash. But I knew that this harmony existed, and I always wanted it. So thank you for being the guy who brought that to me.
And I feel I'm the litmus test for challenging students. I find it difficult to learn in a classroom environment, but I'm doing Toon Boom. I've got it. So I think you've done an excellent job getting through to even the students who are sitting at the back and maybe not quite paying as much attention as they should. I don't know. Well, that was the end of our chat with Stacy. We were using Zoom, and it just dropped out right as he finished saying something. So, Hey, perfect. And he had to run. He'd given us a couple hours of his evening already. So we're really glad to be able to squeeze him in.
Oh, it was fantastic. Really appreciate that, Stacy. If you ever listen back to this, thank you so much for joining us.
I mean, he said he's not a podcast listener. This is the first it's the same thing with animation. He'll do it, but he's not necessarily going to go back and watch it.
Yeah.
But it was a fantastic chat.
Oh, so glad we got to talk for many, many more hours. He's a man with lots of stories, and he says he's done pretty much everything.
And he's a globetrotter.
We
heard a few stories, but it would be just interesting just to hear what is it like to live and work in India for that long, and all the other places, the Italian islands. He's a fascinating guy.
Yeah, really, really good.
Well, that's gonna do us for this episode. So until next time, when we chat with even more of the talented folks from our studio and beyond, keep mucking around, and as Stacy says, keep your sticks on the ice. It's a hockey thing.
We reckon it's a hockey thing.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.